Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello, everybody. Just a quick note before this episode starts. After Rebecca and I recorded our conversation about the wave of Omicron-related cancellations in award season, there were more cancellations, the Governor's Awards being one of the big ones, as well as the Critics' Choice Awards. And by the time you hear this, there might have been more. It's a fast-moving story. So just letting you know that we're a little behind, but we are going to be keeping an eye on this wave of cancellations as they keep coming. Enjoy the episode. Happy holidays. Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm here with Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
And that's it. It's just us. it's a holiday week recording. We wanted to record this week, even though most of our office is closed, because the Academy shortlist is out as of today as we record this, with the shortlist in 10 different categories. But it's also been a pretty newsy week as Omicron kind of sweeps the nation in a bad way. It sweeps the nation, can be good or bad. This one is bad. So we're going to catch up on all of those bits of news. And then later on, you'll hear an interview that David Canfield did with Penelope Cruz, star of Parallel Mothers, shortlisted today in Score, I might add. But let's start with the cancellations. Rebecca, you were tweeting about this as, you know, one of the LA people who would usually spend the first couple weeks of January very, very busy. It sounds like your calendar might clear up after the events of the last few days.
Yeah, it's funny because they all canceled on the same day. So it just felt like one hit after another. But, you know, the first big one was the Palm Springs gala, which is always, except for last year, has always been a very star-studded event. It's sort of a mix of like every big award season contender and then all these sort of eccentric, wealthier people who buy tables in Palm Springs and are, I call them looky-loos because they just like love to look at the celebrities and love film. And it's always a really big event. So I was really excited that it was happening this year. Our colleague David Canfield was going to go. But so that one canceled first. And then, I don't know, maybe an hour later, it was announced that AFI will not be holding their awards luncheon, which again is usually an event that all these stars attend. And then following that quickly, the BAFTA T also canceled.
Which would also be in that same window of January.
Right, and is in LA as well. So,
yeah,
you know, these are all really special events to award season. So I don't know. What it was like a domino effect, I guess.
Yeah. And so now we're kind of looking at the Critics' Choice Awards, which are still, as we record this, scheduled for January 9th. The New York Film Critics Circle dinner was scheduled for the 10th in New York. They postponed as we record this as well. And then the big one that I'm curious about is the Governor's Awards for the Oscars, which is scheduled for January 15th, which is a huge event. And, you know, maybe you can walk through why it's such a big deal. They haven't announced anything. By the time you hear this, they may well have. But I feel like canceling that one would be a really big blow, but it's also hard to know what the safe option is, right?
It does feel like if they're going to cancel, they'll do it this week. I can't imagine them waiting till early January because that event is January 15th in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's an Academy event and it's such a big deal. And I think everyone was really excited that they were able to have it this year. And I was planning on going. And so
yeah,
it's kind of, yeah, like you said, by the time this airs, it may be canceled. But, you know, it's just so hard. You know, I really feel for all these groups because it's so hard to predict the future, even 2 weeks out with the way, you know, Omicron is affecting everything so quickly.
Yeah. And we're in a different place than we were this time in 2020. You know, the vaccines exist. Like, there's, you know, reasons to feel personally like you can be safe. But all of these huge, lavish in-person events where presumably everyone would have masks on, like, it's maybe not a great idea health-wise and optics-wise, I think, is the other part of it. Like, if you're going to throw a big party right now, you might want to have a really good reason, at least if you're in New York and L.A. And they might just not want to deal with the potential blowback and just do the safe thing and cancel.
Yeah, I think it's both of those things. And also the fact that if all these events had stayed on the calendar, the same people are sort of moving from one to the other night after night. And that's just, you know, a recipe sort of for disaster when it comes to this. So
yeah,
it's totally understandable.
You imagine like Jane Campion in New Zealand, Benedict Cumberbatch in England, like Andrew Garfield, wherever, like if all of them are like, I don't feel comfortable going, then eventually you don't have an event anymore because it's relying on those contenders really, like you said, making the circuit.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I feel like January is often, you know, the time of year where because of these events, contenders are, you know, improving their odds or decreasing their odds based on, you know, how they sort of are welcomed at these events or, you mm-hmm. know, what kind of quotes they give at these events. And, you know, they're just staying at the top of mind for voters by appearing at these things. So it is a, you know, an opportunity they all definitely participate in. So it changes the sort of momentum of the season.
Yeah. And it feels like the appetite for another virtual awards campaign is pretty limited. I don't mm-hmm. know if anyone really wants to do that at this point, but
yeah,
you take what you can get, right?
I think we're all zoomed out.
as we speak on Zoom, at least with cameras off, we do ourselves that favor. At this point, I'm feeling pretty optimistic about the Oscars themselves. And I realize that predicting the future at this stage in the pandemic is foolish. So, you know, don't listen to me all that much. But, you know, March is still many months away. If I'm in the Academy, you know, I would maybe be worrying, but I'm personally not too worried about them, like, canceling the Oscars or something like that. Are you with me?
I'm with you. I mean, they were able to pull off the actual awards shows in a sort of safe and limited fashion already for a good year now. And so I think it will happen in some form. You know, maybe they had envisioned having a full audience and all, you know, people like us there. And maybe that's not going to happen. But yeah, late March is still very far away and things can change. But I agree that I don't see the Oscars not happening.
Yeah, people like us were the first ones to be given the virtual option to not be there in person. they don't mind getting us off the deck for that one.
I know, but I missed it last year. I'm really hopeful to go back.
I know. I mean, you know, I'm not in LA, so I didn't have these events on my calendar, but I think I can just kind of sense that disappointment of like, oh, this all this normal stuff, all this like fun gala stuff was going to be happening, and now it's just like we're back to square one, back to like being stuck at home, which is so sad. Everyone go get your booster shots. If there's one thing you can do, save the Oscars, get boosted.
That's probably way down the list on reasons to get boosted, but you know, whatever reason you are listening
to this podcast and you're waiting for your reason, then there you have it. That will get you the Oscars. All right. Well, speaking of the Oscars, as I said, the Academy shortlist in 10 different categories came out today, December 21st, as we record this. And you wrote it up for VF.com, which people can read, and kind of highlighted the not a ton of surprises. I guess there's really just one surprise maybe we should start with. So, Titan, what happened?
Titan. I think that was definitely the surprise. I do feel like because it did not make the list of 15 for international feature. And I do feel like that category always has surprises. But, you know, this film won the Palme at Cannes in May. And that's sort of like a automatic, okay, France nominated it, so it should make the list. But mm-hmm. I do think this film, I mean, it's so well done, and I really respect the filmmaking, but it is a trip. I mean, it's a gory, unconventional film, and I do wonder if that turned some people off to it. You know, it's definitely not traditional. So
yeah,
that's my best guess for it. You know, because that, I think, I agree, was definitely the biggest surprise.
Yeah, I mean, the international feature category, this is a story that's been on for a long time, and the branch has instituted rules to kind of make it so that some of these more challenging movies stand a better chance of getting in. But I don't think you're the only person who thought it would still be a pretty tough road, even for something that's a Palme d'Or winner.
Yeah. And that category has such incredible films competing in it. Not that it doesn't every year, but I feel like more people are talking about the international features than a lot of years.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to say, is that, you know, Flea gets in there from Denmark, A Hero from Iran, Hand of God from Italy, which is right by Netflix, Drive My Car from Japan, which has won a slew of critics' prizes, Worst Person in the World, which we talked about on the show. Like, that's five big deal movies right there. And then I'm sure that there are other great titles in there that I haven't seen because I'm not a perfect human, but I think it'll be a good list anyway.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a great list. And because they're only going to eventually take five, I do think we can easily name more than that than deserve a slot. So
yeah,
it's going to be interesting.
As is often the case. Mm-hmm. You pointed out in your piece, Johnny Greenwood getting two nominations in score, which I think was expected. I didn't expect to see Billie Eilish. I guess her name isn't on there, but Billie Eilish is represented twice in that her documentary got nominated, as did her song from No Time to Die. Is there anyone else who should be especially happy about their performance on these shortlists?
Well, I'm really excited Beyonce and Jay-Z are competing against each other.
Yeah.
You know, Beyonce has the song from King Richard, and Jay-Z has the song from The Harder They Fall, which he also executive produced. So I just imagine them, like, you know, arguing over this in their home. I mean, that's what everyone does, I assume. I mean, that song category is just packed with huge names. So
yeah,
I think that's going to be really interesting to see who gets the actual nominations.
Yeah, I like seeing that the song from Annette, So May We Start, made it mm-hmm. on there. Speaking of like weird, challenging movies that you weren't sure would make it in. But that seemed like a worthy spot to me. And I also, as the fan of Encanto on this podcast, the Spanish language Dos Origuitas, I'm probably saying that wrong. Anyway, written by Lin-Manuel Miranda. He had a very busy year, and he this is the song that qualified. So that would get him his EGOT, I think. We'll see. Yep. We'll see how that shakes out.
Yeah, it's so interesting because he also has Tick, Tick, Boom, obviously, and In the Heights. So he's just like all over this. He could get to that EGOT a bunch of different ways.
Yeah, it feels like really a matter of when, not if, for him.
Yeah.
But we'll see. I want to know what you make of Belfast showing up in the sound category, which can really run the gamut. There's a lot of musicals in there, which often happens, and then Dune and Matrix Resurrections. But both Belfast and The Power of the Dog being in there, I thought was an interesting indication of some broader support they might have when all the nominations come out.
Yeah, I think you're totally right that being mentioned in these shortlist categories does indicate sort of wider support. I think Belfast, there is something about movies that have, you know, either obviously wartime scenes or mm-hmm. And there's these riot scenes in Belfast and that I thought were really well done. So I do wonder if that helped, you know, boosted in the sound category.
Yeah. I also thought about the scenes where they're at the movies and you're kind of hearing audio from a movie within the movie that you're watching. And I'm betting that's more complicated than you think to make that feel right for you to listen to it yourself.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, and these are the voters are within these branches, so they really are sort of experts on this, which,
yeah,
you know, us lay people may not notice things in the sound category that they are able to notice and sort of highlight, I think.
Yeah, although I think you and I share a love for interviewing these people, and they just like explain it and you're like, whoa, like, thank you for revealing the witchcraft that goes into what they can do.
Oh my gosh, the best stories. I love when, especially when the sound team is like, I used a broom in my garage to make the noise. And I'm like, I love it. Like, they're just so creative. And I feel like they just, anytime they do an interview, I'm totally entertained.
Yeah. If you are rooting for the Oscars to pay attention to blockbusters, Spider-Man qualified in visual effects and in sound. So maybe it will get some nominations and get the Marvel people to watch. Anything else that you're paying attention to out of these?
I mean, I think it's interesting that both No Time to Die actually got the most mentions of all these shortlists, and Dune followed with four. So, I mean, obviously a lot of these categories are crafts, which both those films are really strong in. But, you know, those are both big movies. So I think that's exciting to see. And we'll have to see if that continues to play out with nominations.
Oh, and I should really say that seeing my beloved Green Knight show up in score, I love, because when I walked out of the movie, I was just thinking about Daniel Hart, who did the score for that movie, which is wonderful. I don't know how steep a road it is for an actual nomination, but I was happy to see it there.
Yeah, I think these shortlists always help because people can see them and be like, oh, yes, that movie that I loved so much, but I've kind of forgotten about because of all the other movies. So,
yeah,
who knows? We can cross our fingers for The Green Knight.
Yeah, or Cyrano, which we both really like, making it in the makeup and hairstyling category, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. I was happy to see, too. I mean, along with Aziz Tamifay, No Time to Die, like some very Cruella, like big, prominent yep. makeup movies that might steal the thunder. We'll see.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So we have the nomination shortlist. As we mentioned, what's going to be happening in early January is really up in the air. And then the actual final nominations don't come out until February 8th. So it's going to be a while. Before we listen to David talk to Penelope Cruz, anything you're watching, Rebecca, or anything you want to tell people to watch while we have their attention one last time before the year wraps up? I mean, we'll have an episode next week, but we recorded already. So this is really our last gasp for 2021.
I mean, I just watched Drive My Car. I was a little late for that one. And you know, our colleague David really loved it. And I'm so glad I got to see it. So I think if you haven't caught that one yet, obviously it just made the international feature shortlist. It's a really special film.
I wanted to just shout out the Los Angeles Film Critics Association that gave the Best Actor Award to Simon Rex for Red Rocket, which we have mm-hmm. talked about, I'm sure. But if anyone needed one last reminder to see this kind of like dirty, not silly movie, but like funny and kind of gross sometimes movie, it's got their stamp of approval. And he's really, really fantastic in it. So go check that one out.
I do feel like that's probably not the one you watch over the holidays with your parents, but
no, that is the one for like after everyone's gone to bed and you don't feel yeah. like going to bed yet. Like for that you have House of Gucci or Encanto or there's
West
a lot
Side
to choose
Story.
From. Yeah, yeah, a lot of options out there. Well, then let's go ahead and hear David Canfield's conversation with Penelope Cruz.
Well, last we spoke, you told me that Pedro Almodovar called you when you were 18 years old. And I wanted to start there right at the beginning. That was the first time you'd spoken. What do you remember about that call? Do you look back on it now as kind of a life-changing moment?
Completely life-changing. It was like an old friend that was calling back after a long time. It didn't feel new. It didn't feel he was someone new in my life. Maybe because I knew him so well from cinema. So many incredible things have happened to me because of him and because this relationship. And he's like another family member, you know, he's not just someone I work with. Mm.
You've said you can't hide anything from him. I'm wondering, is there a kind of freedom in that for you as an actor? How does that inform the way you are in his movies?
I prefer it to be this way because also he can't lie to me either. Right. So if I do something and he's not convinced, he will tell me. But if he doesn't, I will see it anyway. And we know that about each other. We know like we can feel each other, read each other's minds almost. And it's good because we never abuse the confidence of, oh, we're good friends or we relax on set with each other. Oh, no. We almost change the way we behave with each other on set and become a little more distant. We didn't plan that, but I think we do it to protect the relationship and the work.
Has that evolved over time from film to film, or was it always like that for you?
Always like that. Maybe at the beginning, the first couple of movies, we were more like, ha, 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 because we had just met. And later, we were becoming so close and knowing each other so well that it was like, okay, yeah, we can laugh and joke when we are in a dinner. It doesn't mean there is no humor on the set. Some mm-hmm. days there is, but it's all about the work and about protecting that. And that way, we end up protecting also the friendship.
Yeah. So you've known about this role in a very loose sense for over 20 years now, right? He told you about it and around All About My Mother that time. What do you remember about when he first told you about it? And I imagine it changed quite a bit from there.
He told me about the two women, what happened to them at the hospital. And he told me about playing the younger character because it was so long ago. Right. But I always wanted to play the photographer. The photographer, Janice, she stayed with me all these years. So when he told me, I said, Pedro, I remember you shared this with me. And I think he didn't remember that. He shares with me all the stories he's thinking about and then he forgets. Because I don't keep asking him, oh, by the way, when are you going to do this? I'm very respectful to that. But last month he shared an incredible story to us. And now we are all wondering, is he going to do that? Because he has this great imagination and always creating. He's always like writing three things at the same time.
Do you have other stories that he's told you in your head still from over the years that like roles that you might like to play?
There was one scene that he described to me that it was a panic attack. And I read that somewhere. And then it was not in any of the scripts. And that is always my mystery. Pedro, where was that panic attack scene? It was incredible. Because the description of it, of how it happened, it was like so good and so scary.
Oh, wow.
And he's like, it's true. That's familiar. No, yeah, you wrote it. What is it? Right. Incredible.
Yeah, it's got to pop up someday.
I remember everything he ever shares with me and everything that I have read. That has not been done, like everything.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Janice, who is such a complicated character, and she's someone who has to hide quite a bit without spoiling anything. How did you start to figure her out, get into her headspace? What was that process like for you?
Janice expressed her feelings in a very different way than I do. In a situation like that, I would be crying all day long. Mm-hmm. It's my tools for sanity, you know, like to be able to cry, to express myself out of happiness, emotion, sadness, anger. It's just really therapeutic for me. But for some people, that's harder. Janice is harder than me in that way. Like, it's not so much in contact with her own emotions. And when we started rehearsing, Milena and I would start reading and would start crying because it was so strong, the script and what happens to them. And he was very patient and he said, I understand, we're going to go through this process. You can cry all you want now, but we're not going to have your own tears mixed with the ones of the characters. And these characters don't cry as much as you. We got what he wanted to, where he wanted to get. But that took a while because it was like, start reading and look at all the situations that they go through. And once we found that, which is the tone for part of the beginning, after she finds the news. When I went back and watched it, like I understood very well. He showed me half an hour in the middle of the shooting and I understood. It's almost like a thriller. It's almost like film noir. It's like a ticking bomb. And that's what I was feeling like for 2 months of the shooting. It was like such an adrenaline trip, like building up to that moment where she's going to explode and confess. And in that moment, he allowed me to, you know, be able to have that emotional release where she's like crying, screaming, throwing up in the floor of the bathroom. Like the audience needs that release with her at that point, but not before. And to get that, you know, like it was like necessary to have all those months of like releasing like our own feelings in respect of the characters and drawing that to be able to get into that tone of contention and that ticking bomb. And then at the point when she confesses, okay, then that is a release that she needs and the audience will really need.
Yeah, it's very cathartic for me.
But if that would have happened from scene one,
yeah, exactly,
it would have been a completely different movie.
Definitely.
So I think that's what makes him so incredible as a director. Mm.
That kind of rehearsal time is quite a luxury for an actor. Is that common for you working with Pedro, or did it feel extra, you know, an extra amount of time compared to usual?
With him, we always have rehearsal time. sometimes like 3 months. In this one, we rehearsed more and it was necessary. And we had that time because we were in pre-production, like he finished the script very early. The departments were not ready. So we needed to have that time. And we are very grateful for him to give us that time. When I work with a director that doesn't have a plan to rehearse, I prepare by myself. I do that research. I work with my acting teacher, Juan Carlos Coraza, and I love going to the studio and prepare there. But the research process is as important as the shooting or more, and I enjoy it so much.
But I imagine you don't get that on other films that are not Pedro as much. No,
some directors prefer, you know, like not to have a long rehearsal time and then you prepare by yourself, which is okay also. I mean, I'm not saying, oh, this is the only way that things can work.
Yeah.
And with him, I don't prepare by myself. I arrive like from zero with him. We start together from zero.
Well, your co-star in this film, you have such a rich relationship. What was it like working with Milena and finding that dynamic between these two women?
It was very easy because we connected from day one. And I think she's a great actress. I think things will go very well for her. We needed to really trust each other to do this. And it just happened. It was easy from day one. It was a very strong connection, very comfortable with each other. It was so important to find the right person for that character. And we did. And I think she's great in the film.
Yeah, she really is. So you mentioned wanting to play a photographer. What about that part of Janice did you key into? Why was that an attractive job for you to play, for lack of a better way of putting it?
Because I love photography. I have so many friends that are photographers. I've been taking pictures since I was a teenager. Having this smartphone has made me kind of abandon my hobby photography because you have the camera there, so you don't carry your own camera, and it's never the same.
It's not the same.
And it makes me sad. You know, I had a Leica that Annie Leibovitz gave me as a present. I have it at home somewhere. And I was thinking, why don't I carry that with me? And I used to take pictures all the time. Now I only take pictures of my children. But I don't know. It's something different about taking them with your phone.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I like that, you know, like the independency of this character. She's a very cool, complicated character, complex. I always wanted to play her from the moment I heard about it 20 years ago.
Pedro, and you've talked about this, has been casting you as mothers pretty consistently over the course of his films, before you even were one yourself. Why do you think he always saw that maternal quality in you and wanted to bring that out in his films? Have you? I'm curious if you've spoken about that at all.
Because he always saw that in me, because if we were taking a walk in the street and I saw a baby, I was always like picking it up without even asking, like always going to strangers and I love children. And I always knew I wanted to be a mother since I was a little girl. I've been saying that. I have a very strong maternal instinct and he always saw it because he's my friend and he just, it's not planned. He just was writing and thought about who's right for this character. And then he would call me and either pregnant, like my first movie with him, I was in birth in a bus, or a mother, except for Broken Embraces.
Mm-hmm. And often in some perilous situations.
I mean, very peculiar situations, always. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Always. Nothing easy, not easy lives.
No. But I imagine that makes it a little bit more fun as an actor.
No, of course. I mean, the most challenging the character is, and the more difficult, the better. Of course, it's like I get there feeling like completely terrified. Like the first few days, I feel really scared. And that is my engine, you know, like I need that fear. I don't ever want that to go away or to feel too confident. That would be really bad in this profession, I think.
What was it like coming off of Pain and Glory, in which you are kind of in effect playing a version of his mother, a version of him, his mother? How was that experience for you?
I mean, it was short because I only worked for 2 weeks, but it was an honor to play his mom. I met her many years ago and she was crying with me, telling me about how proud she was and how terrified she had been in the past when Pedro told her that he was going to quit the job at the telephone company because she thought that he was very safe there and he was going to risk everything for the cinema. And that now he was right and everything worked out. And she was crying. And she was so lovely. And I understood a lot about Pedro's personality, you know, from that conversation. And also, I didn't know at that point, that was like 25 years ago, no, 20 years ago. I didn't know that it was going to be so important for me later, for Pain and Glory, where I was playing her, to have experienced the essence of her, of this mother.
Right. Because all of his movies, or many of his movies, are about motherhood and about that quality, I imagine there was a lot to draw on, not only in that, but in your past work with him and knowing how he writes about and thinks about mothers.
Yeah, and especially in Volver, because we went to his neighborhood where he grew up, and we saw, you know, the atmosphere is still the same in terms of the relationship with the neighbors. And I could imagine Pedro spying from the door of his house, spying the conversations of the neighbors and learning from all those women, observing them and planning his future, you know, as a storyteller. He was a good student, but most of his time there was observing the dynamic between these women, observing what they were saying and what they were not saying.
Yep.
And you understand a lot about who he is because of all those women around, the mother, the sisters, the neighbors. And he's done so much for women. The characters, the female characters that he has written every time are such an incredible homage to women. And he understands us so well. Mm.
Do your own experiences in motherhood, have they affected how you've approached these kinds of roles now? Do you find a deeper or different kind of attachment to them?
I feel I understood before, and you can play a mother if you haven't been, like the same way you can play a drug addict or a nun or be in any situation that maybe you haven't been. Because I always had that instinct, that maternal instinct. I feel maybe it doesn't make such a big difference. Now, maybe I get even more obsessed when something like that happens to a character, and more upset personally when a scene finishes. Like one day Pedro had to pick me up from the floor and was kind of angry with me and said, like, I want you to do the same without suffering. But I looked at him like, what are you talking about? what is the way? I don't know the way, but you don't know the way either. Because if you see in what state he is when we're shooting, sometimes he worries me because you feel that he could give his life for the movie. So I could not take that advice from him. And I try not to take that energy home. But sometimes I have to stay there like 1 hour after finishing to come back to reality because it's not like automatic.
Yeah.
But I'm not complaining about that. It's an amazing ride, an amazing adventure, you know, every one of those days of going into somebody else's reality. And you need that truth there, and you're doing it for them. You know, unfortunately, it's fiction, but you're touching subjects that are the reality of many people in the world. Maybe not what happens to Janice and Anna, but any kind of threat about losing what you love the most, in this case, children. So there has to be truth. It cannot be about protecting yourself. I don't want to suffer doing those things. No, you have to go all the way. And the safety net is that, you know, you are doing a fiction, but it's going to touch you and move you. And it's going to hurt because you know that there are people in the world going through situations like that. So you cannot look away from that.
Yeah.
So that's it. I think the beauty of this profession, the beauty of acting is like always to do it for, you know, for others and in the name of honoring that, you know, like even if it's as painful as it can be, that deserves to be told with truth.
Yeah. No, I love that. I'll finish by asking you kind of a big question. This might be my favorite performance of yours.
Thank you so much.
I'm curious for you, how do you see yourself as having grown as an actor? If you take yourself back to that first film you made with Pedro and now, what does that journey look like for you?
I always see myself as a student, you know. I look back and I see my first two movies, Jamón, Jamón, Belle Époque. I was very lucky because they were very different from each other. So it was like a good presentation card of doing these two different things. And then Pedro came into my life and I'm a student of life. It's not just about my profession or acting. Acting is... You never get to a place where you feel confident, where you feel, okay, now I know everything I had to learn from. Never. I mean, always like beginning, always from zero. Of course, there is like the years of experience behind and you learn and that's there with you. And also your experiences in life and that are going to get mixed with your own work because we work, you know, we study human behavior, human confusion. It's the beauty of that for me is like, it doesn't end. So I imagine like if we talk when I'm 90, I would be telling you exactly the same thing. I don't think I would get tired of acting because of that, because you are always new.
That does it for this week's show. As we mentioned, we'll be back next week with an episode that we all recorded together to talk about West Side Story, the original as well as the new one, which we have made very clear how much we love. And we'll have two interviews on that episode as well. So lots to hear from before the new year begins. In the meantime, Rebecca, we're all taking a much needed break, but you can find us on VF.com in some ways and on Twitter. I'm at Katie Rich and Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
And we're all on Twitter at Little Gold Men, where we'd love to hear from you. Or you can text us at Subtext. Join subtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 213-513-7215. This week's episode was edited and produced by Brett Bukes. And have a happy new year.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.